This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I've asked Dr. Tim Garrett from Utah why climate change will lead to inflation. He's given the example of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where prices went up briefly due to short supplies. Let's hear more.
Now, what you can think about global warming being is, in some sense, it's like a long-term natural disaster. It is not only a long-term natural disaster that happens continuously, unlike Katrina, which was momentarily, but it also happens globally. So with Katrina, it was instantaneous, effectively instantaneous, and they caused a short-term inflation. But then people were able to come in from outside and provide new resources that stabilized the New Orleans economy. Now, I was in New Orleans, things were expensive still, but, you know, it wasn't out of this world. But in a future world, you can imagine, now, this is slightly speculative, but it's consistent with what you would expect from the physics. You could imagine that there is an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And this will be an inflationary pressure that cannot be supplanted by outside resources from outside because it is acting globally. It will be affecting everybody.
Right. If we have rising seas, for example, eating up some of our best farmland or salinating it, there's just you can't make some more land like that. It's gone.
Exactly.
So that pushes up the price of all the remaining land, and that's how climate change can create inflation, for example.
Yes.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down. And eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million. And that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did, and then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming, at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
Well, I hear people suggesting that we could make a big cut in carbon emissions just with energy efficiency. We'll all get electric cars and we'll put in the light bulbs. And I've heard that you don't think so much about energy efficiency as a way to save ourselves.
Well, actually, it's almost counterintuitive, but no, in fact, it's the other way around. The whole reason that civilization has been so successful and has grown so quickly is that we are energy efficient. It is our efficiency of taking material goods and energy and converting them into production and net growth that actually leads to us producing carbon dioxide. The increasingly efficient we become, the more efficient we become at growing civilization and its wealth. I think this is actually common sense. I mean, we always strive for efficiency because we have some underlying sense that efficiency is good for our general well-being. But our general well-being is normally measured in terms of economic wealth. And as I showed, economic wealth has a direct correspondence to carbon dioxide emissions. So increasing energy efficiency leads to more energy consumption, and more energy consumption leads to more carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has actually been pointed out by energy economists ever since the late 1800s. So I'm not sure why it's not more generally accepted today.
Just on a personal level, I have a camper van, but I don't drive it to Mexico anymore because I don't want to put all those carbon emissions up there. But if it got 100 miles to the gallon, well, maybe I'd drive further. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
Oh, of course, yeah. No, it's like the beer fridge in the basement. No, I just bought one of those because my upstairs fridge is actually fairly efficient these days.
You know, the study of economy has been called the dismal science, and your paper might qualify for that title. The abstract reads, "There are no plausible thermodynamically supported solutions that avoid inflation rates less than 100% and lead to stabilized atmospheric CO2 concentrations within this century." To me, that says we either get worthless money or a dangerous atmosphere or both. Are these our choices?
I don't see any other options. I mean, I suppose what you could argue is that civilization could decarbonize, switch to renewables and nuclear power at such an extraordinarily fast rate that in some sense we decouple ourselves from the atmosphere. So in other words, we are able to keep consuming energy without affecting atmospheric composition. But even there, there's actually, I mean, in some sense, it's rather amusing. Well, it's intellectually amusing, at least, that decarbonizing civilization will actually not be as effective as one might expect. Now, decarbonizing civilization, let's say we were to do this proactively, presumably it would cost money, and we would only do it with the expectation that it would help alleviate the worst damages of global warming. And I think that makes sense. You know, why would we do it otherwise? We would put in the effort because it will benefit us in the long run. But remember, anything that benefits us in the long run is effectively measurable as an increase in our wealth. And an increase in our wealth will translate to an increase in energy consumption. So in essence, what happens is decarbonizing promotes our wealth and our energy consumption in the future. But increasing our energy consumption, as long as we are partly a fossil fuel economy, will correspond to increasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So that doesn't completely offset the decarbonization gains, but because it promotes society health, we actually do not gain as much from decarbonizing as one might initially expect, because it's a dynamic system and we would actually continue to grow faster than we would otherwise.
I can see it. I mean, if we build a lot of nuclear power plants, it's going to take some carbon shovels to get all that cement going, and all the materials still have to be brought out. We're going to use oil to do it. And so there might actually be a burst of new emissions just trying to do that.
Well, yeah, there's that too, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is... In some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. Because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter. Just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds than clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time. And because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s. And it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks. And these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
You know, you're kind of a troublemaker in a way here. Because we've got a lot of people who are looking for a realistic way out of this awful dilemma, and you've got a really sharp mind that... It seems to be you can stick some pins in the balloon and away it goes. But I guess that really is what science is about. I mean, we're looking for what is real and what works and what doesn't.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, these are interesting physics problems. And I mean, one of the privileges of, you know, being a university scientist is, of course, that, I don't know, you get to think about these problems for the simple joy of thinking about them. And if the answers end up one way or rather than the other, well, that's, well, so be it. I mean, it's the joys in trying to figure something out. Yeah, I mean, that's for me, that was the fun of doing the economics problem. I mean, I have no background in economics, but I am as much a player as anybody else in the economic system. And wouldn't it be fun if it is possible to understand the economic system using the tools that, well, I, as a physicist, understand from my research and doing clouds.
Well, as we've just found out, the economists don't understand the economy either. Look, our guest has been Dr. Timothy Garrett, Associate Professor, Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. He's been researching the relationships between energy, wealth, and greenhouse gas emissions. Tim, people seem really enthusiastic about your work, even though it shows us playing right into some kind of end game. Isn't that strange?
You know, I don't know how much enthusiasm there really is, but I mean, it's, you know, I think that in a lot of ways, people have some sort of hunch that things like energy efficiency actually leads to more energy consumption. And we hear this, you know, repeated mantra that it leads to less energy consumption. But I think, you know, we always think that energy efficiency increases our ability to lead wealthy, happy lives. And I don't know, wealthy, happy lives tends to correspond to increased energy consumption. So I think, you know, some people are just more receptive to really fairly intuitive, obvious ideas. And perhaps in another perspective, you know, maybe this is a very cynical statement, but if things are really truly are hopeless, well then, you know, we don't have to worry as much. We can just enjoy the present.
Let's party like it's 1999. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Tim Garrett.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
As you've heard, there are big changes in the Arctic. The temperature is going up rapidly. Sea ice and glaciers are melting. The permafrost is giving way. That's why I was excited to get out and record the latest. In a speech called Drivers of Environmental Change, The Case of the Arctic. The speaker was a polar veteran, Marie-Francois André, of the University of Blaise Pascal, Clermont-Ferrand, France. I welcome the opportunity for a European perspective, known for climate science leadership. As I listened, my head began to quietly explode. The latest science was missing. The old refrains of denial emerged, and another roomful of college students was misled about climate science, I think. How could this happen again? I didn't see any brochures for oil companies lying about. The lecture series appears to be funded by the Liu Institute for Global Issues, which is relatively progressive. I believe this lecture represents yet another current of discontent among scientists whose work has been overshadowed by the spotlight on climate change. So we'll give it a few minutes for others who run into this strange twist, and those influenced by it, you can recognize the symptoms. Over her career, Dr. André has made 19 field expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctic. How could she deny the major changes there, obvious to the naked eye? She does not. A good part of this lecture, given October 28, 2010, consisted of slides showing massive changes in ice fields, sea ice, and glaciers. The warming is obvious. André is not a climate denier. She questions whether the changes are consistent with human-induced climate change and whether we will really see significant impacts, such as rising seas. I did learn from Dr. André. For example, I did not realize the huge extent of frozen ice under the northern continents holds so much of the world's fresh water. Let's hear just a bit about the permafrost.
You have on the right the hidden ice, I mean the permafrost ice, the ground ice, which covers much space in Arctic and subarctic regions. Permafrost occupies 50% of Canada, 60% of Russia, and the 85 of Alaska.
Amazing. And with rapid Arctic warming, all this land will eventually thaw, releasing vast amounts of water vapor into the atmosphere, where it is a global warming gas, and massive runoff into the rivers and oceans, adding to rising sea levels. Most of the structures, pipelines, homes, and forests will be destabilized as this underground ocean of ice melts. Dr. Andre did not discuss this. We learned that there are human-caused changes in the Arctic, all right, even though only 4 million people live within the Arctic Circle. She tells us about the localized impacts of settlements, especially the old Russian factory cities, and the growing impact of Arctic tourism on the delicate plant life. I cannot seriously equate these with the vast melting of the polar worlds, but it gives us a clue to Andre's motivations, in my opinion. Dr. Marie-Francois Andre is not a climatologist. Like the host for this series and her co-author in a book, the Canadian scientist Olaf Slaymaker, Marie-Francois is a geomorphologist. According to Wikipedia, quote, "Geomorphology is the scientific study of landforms and the processes that shape them, and more broadly, the evolution of processes controlling the topography of any planet. Geomorphologists seek to understand why landscapes look the way they do, to understand landform history and dynamics, and to predict future changes through a combination of field observation, physical experiment, and numerical modeling," end quote. Geomorphology is often placed within geography. It seemed evident, to me at least, that Dr. Andre is one of several disciplines who see more media, more research money and equipment going to climate science, while their important contributions are passed by. We do know from the work of Canadian scientists that climate events, such as the major sea ice melt and heating of 2007, can radically reshape the geomorphology of the Arctic. On one Canadian island studied, old rivers were blocked as whole landscapes slipped down hillsides over the melting ice below. These big changes likely happened across the whole Canadian North in that one season alone. That is large-scale change from Arctic warming, which cannot be compared to the foot traffic on Svalbard trampling plants. These lesser influences, championed by Dr. Andre, should not be ignored. The Arctic is fragile, and we need to protect that environment, just as she says. But Andre is critical of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As it sounded to me, she suggested, the IPCC has been taken over by something like a cult. In particular, she laments the loss of the medieval warm period, as shown on a graph presented by the IPCC back in 1990. That assessment was later replaced by the famous hockey stick graph produced by Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Andre tells the students,
there is now a view which is in between, before the first one and Mann's one, and there were many articles saying that the medieval optimum had been stolen, and suddenly, well, there is a kind of revival. It's what I mean is that if IPCC in this group, you have some people or some groups of people who are very powerful, and they provide a vision, their vision. And now, after this, well, it was something of a mess, I mean, after the report, now there are different views which are offered. But what is important to us is it's that finally the medieval optimum, the fact that the Middle Ages climate was a bit warmer than ours, is again admitted. Well, let's say that the debate continues and will continue for some time, I am afraid. So you can see the problem. Some people say if the climate was warmer in the Middle Ages, probably it's not because we pollute the atmosphere that the present climate warming exists. So you can see the implications behind. So one can understand why it's difficult.
As Joe Rahm often says in his blog, climateprogress.org, you have to put your head in a vise to continue with this kind of logic. Contrary to the impression given by Andre, Dr. Mann did not use just tree ring data to construct his graph. Studies from all over the world, including such things as coral and ice cores, show the European warming around the year 1000 was probably a local event. possibly caused by a change of ocean currents. It was not a globally experienced warming, as far as we can find out. The medieval globe was not warmer than today.
The Vikings. Talk to a climate denier long enough, and he's sure to start telling you about the Vikings. The climate deniers love the Vikings. It's an article of absolute faith among climate deniers that 1,000 years ago, the whole planet was warmer than today, and that the current warming is just part of a grand cycle mediated by the sun or some other mechanism.
You must see Peter Sinclair's Climate Denier Croc of the Week on medieval warming, found on YouTube. Find that link in my blog for this show at ecoshock.info. The American National Academy of Sciences was asked by Congress to investigate Dr. Mann's work. They found the new IPCC map of climate over time was accurate. The hockey stick graph, which shows the present is much, much hotter than the medieval warm period, stands. It has been cross-checked by the Academies of Science worldwide. The French Academy of Science stands behind it, as Marie-Francois knows well.
Most of what I said was dealing with the warming trend, which is the main mainstream, what most of the people say, at least the most influential people, but many people. And some others have a completely different view. Some predict and even already observe a cooling trend. They describe a cooling trend that would have begun either in 1998 or in 2002. And they say that we are at the beginning of a cooling period like the one we experienced in the 1950s and 60s.
After puckishly suggesting the world might be cooling and showing us a graph supposedly showing cooling over the past 10 years, Dr. André admitted, after my question, that nobody in France talks about global cooling anymore. So why does she tell students it is a possibility? In the face of NASA data showing the first years of this century to be among the hottest ever recorded, year after year, after 30,000 French people died in the massive heatwave of 2003... Dr. André uses Peter Ward's new book, The Flooded Earth, literally as a poster boy for alarmists. Against all the recent findings by top European and American institutes, which warn of a minimum 5-foot sea level rise this century, André doubts sea level will rise, well, hardly at all. She explains this is because more snow is piling up on Greenland and even more on eastern Antarctica. This extra snow will absorb both the expansion of the oceans and the melting ice. She does not tell students that hard data from the American GRACE satellites refutes this theory. The satellites measure changes in gravity, showing a big loss of ice mass on both Greenland and, surprisingly, even in the coldest parts of Antarctica. André said nothing about recent polar science from NASA, NOAA, MIT, the National Academy, or the Geophysical Union. The data presented stopped at 2007. She plainly preferred the chart from the 1990 IPCC report. All through, we heard some say, and veiled accusations that climate critics had to hide carefully behind their words. It felt like we were at a secret meeting of apostates. I wanted to demand half an hour to refute, a chance to explain to the students that a boatload of expert science contradicted André's suggestions about the Arctic. But I was just a guest, allowed to record a speech. Only two questions were asked, and then people filed out of the room, turning on their iPods and iPhones. This series at St. John's College, part of the University of British Columbia, is designed to explore uncertainty about climate change. It ends next spring with Canada's own science doubter, Dr. Vaclav Smil. He told Andrew Revkin of the New York Times there has been no global warming in the past 10 years. He must have been away during the past decade on some other planet. Bring your own head vice for that one. I won't be there. I'm Alex Smith.